Welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast. I'm Brett King.
And I'm Jason Henricks. Every week since 2013, we explore the personalities, startups, innovators, and industry players driving disruption in financial services.
From incumbents to unicorns, and from cutting-edge technology to the people using it to help create a more innovative, inclusive, and healthy financial future. I'm JP Nichols, and this is Breaking Banks.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. I am your host, Brett King. Today I have joining me in the hosting chair, Dara Takowski. Dara, thanks for joining us.
Happy to do it.
How's Tech on Reg going?
You know, new listeners every day. I'm recording an election-oriented episode later today, so everyone's got to tune in on October 13th.
Well, yeah, you have to talk about the implications of the president getting corona as well. But anyway, it'll be interesting.
New developments every day. Never a dull moment.
And we're very grateful to have the support of our sponsor, Sherman and Sterling, also for this episode. Joining us is Barney Reynolds. He's the global head of the financial services industry group at Sherman Sterling. Am I pronouncing that right, Barney? Sherman?
Yeah, that's right. And
Sherman and Sterling? Yep, thanks for joining us. So you're a member of the firm's executive group. You advise people on financial market or all types of financial market participants, governments in London, Eurozone, globally. Obviously, you do a lot of work with fintechs as well, being European-based. You're focused on financial institution law, regulation, and legal risk, so legal risk management. So we get into that often in the show. Not from a legal perspective necessarily, but certainly from a regulatory policy perspective and some of the comparisons of different markets. So thanks for joining us, buddy.
Pleasure. Thanks for inviting me on.
Let's start with, obviously, the Brexit. Now, prior to Brexit occurring, we had no idea coronavirus was, going to come along, and that's obviously accentuated the economic effects of the Brexit for Britain. But give us a state of play where we're at on the Brexit now.
Sure. So negotiations are ongoing between the UK and EU for a future relationship, predominantly a trading relationship, because the UK is leaving the EU sovereign wrapper. The sovereignty wrapper or the federal wrapper that the EU places over its member states. The UK left formally in January, beginning of this year, but is applying EU law until the end of the year, during which time it's negotiating its future relationship on the basis of an agreed framework or template set out in something called a political declaration. And negotiations have been rather slow, to be frank, because the EU's propositions to the UK for the past few months have been incompatible with Brexit and involve the idea of continued application of EU law and the jurisdiction of the EU's highest court, the European Court of Justice, over the UK after the end of this year, including, for instance, in relation to subsidisation rules which between states are normally dealt with under the WTO or enhancements to the WTO mechanics. The EU would like the UK to adopt EU law for dealing with subsidisation. The EU is also proposing that the UK give up some level of sovereignty over its fishing waters, again, incompatible with Brexit. So it's been a difficult few months in the negotiations. An awful lot of the trade... future trade relationship has been agreed in the context of the sort of arrangements in place between the EU and Canada, which is a sort of normalized FTA, free trade agreement, and that covers goods and agriculture and a few other bits and pieces. But the two topics I mentioned are outstanding, and as yet we don't know whether the parties are going to be able to agree something on services and financial services, which really is where the bulk of the UK economy operates, at 80% of the economy, with 20% being goods and agriculture. So that's where we are. In terms of the negotiations, I suppose, a bit qu- quiet recently. There have been no doubt discussions at a high level on the sticking points. But really, the question remains whether the EU and the key member states in the EU are looking to move straight away at the end of this year to a relationship with a close neighbour and friend that respects UK sovereignty and is based on a sort of template that the EU already has in place with Canada and now Japan, or whether the EU is not ready for that and is really looking somehow to claw back some of the benefits of having the UK under its federal umbrella, which I think would then mean that there is no deal at the end of this year. And in fact, I think the withdrawal agreement that was signed and effective from the end of January this year would need to be torn up, because that basically provided for this 11-month negotiation, and that was the main thing.
So it doesn't end in a hard Brexit then?
There are two different concepts of points about hard Brexit. I mean, I think it would be a truly hard Brexit if nothing is agreed and the future relationship by year end, because the withdrawal agreement gave 11 months for the negotiation on the template of the political declaration. If that's not, and the EU in fact agreed to use best endeavours and good faith, which are very meaningful obligations under international law, to get there, in my view, it's been structurally incapable of progressing in accordance with those obligations because of the governance processes within the EU. So in fact, it came up with at the outset a so-called negotiating mandate, which wasn't really a negotiating mandate. It was a position paper, which is at odds with the whole concept under international law of good faith, best endeavours negotiations towards this outcome. So I think structurally it's probably been in a box that it can't get out of, which it can't execute on those obligations. So, and if it can't properly execute on those obligations, then the whole thing falls away, including the so-called the Northern Ireland Protocol. And the UK would have to then start from outside completely under the WTO system. It would have to provide for an invisible north-south border on the island of Ireland in some other way. And there are two other ways to do it, the main one being using alternative arrangements, which is basically the state-of-the-art customs and border technologies, and would have to proceed on that basis until the EU is willing to talk. My belief is there'll be a deal, but really it's down to whether or not the EU can accept the sort of sovereign relationship it's committed to provide that is kind of intrinsic to the point of Brexit.
Barney, the clock really is ticking though, right? Because the transition period was said to be ending by December 31st. And I think the deadline for extending that has also now passed, right?
Yes. And I think because of the EU's governance structure, you have to remember the federal overlay in the EU. I mean, the Commission's role, Monsieur Barnier's role, in a way is disempowered. There's no sort of empowered body sitting above him in the sense of a federal structure, sort of a quasi-federal structure. It's sort of incomplete. It's not built out. In reality, you then go back to member states. Obviously, Germany and France are the most powerful voices in that thing, but it's not like dealing with the US or a proper federal state. And so the governance process is such that I think it's inevitable that things come down to the wire, because only then do the relevant parties get together in a room and actually start thrashing out the compromises between themselves, largely, as to what Brexit involves for them.
Yeah. So economically, have we started to see any impact from Brexit as yet?
I'm not an economist. It's not been reported as being particularly noticeable in terms of actual Brexit impacts. In fact, that's been a controversy in the UK press, because there are all sorts of dire predictions of the effects of Brexit by economists in the run-up to the referendum vote and in the aftermath, which haven't turned out to be correct. Obviously, there are economic impacts of COVID. Within those, whether there's anything to do with Brexit, I don't know whether one can disentangle that, but it doesn't look like it. I think that, you know, COVID affects everyone, the EU and UK, obviously, together. And it kind of brings into play another point, which is why I think there will be a deal, which is the EU's legal architecture is, I've already alluded to the fact that it's half built for its, in terms of its federal governance, but it's dangerously hard built for its monetary and fiscal governance. So the Eurozone, purports to be a sovereign currency zone, and the ECB operates currency. But in fact, the fiscal underpinnings of the zone remain member states driven. There's a very limited element of grants that's been agreed at the pan-EU level for COVID, but in the scheme of things, a small number. But the member states basically raise their own capital, as it were. And the problem with that, for the world, not just the UK, and the problem for the US as well, is it's extremely risky. So in the context of the financial markets, EU law operates on the presumption that the zone is financed centrally through sovereign debt, but actually it's not. It's financed locally through member state debt, which is more like municipal bond debt in the United States. So the Eurozone has no sovereign paper. Sovereign paper is the underpinning for the global financial market because it's the one thing you can count on. It's cash, basically, that, as being worth 100% for collateral purposes and always being there when you need it for liquidity purposes, and it attracts no regulatory capital. EU law operates in denial of that fact and assumes that all of this member state paper is sovereign. And what that does is pumps vast financial risk trillions into the global financial markets, putting the assets of savers, investors, and investors at risk, which is something
maybe. The Eurozone's been in place for, a few decades now, and we haven't seen significant, unhinging of Eurozone currency as a result, but I see what you're saying. Let's talk about trade though, because obviously the one thing we want to see after Brexit is getting back to some activity of normalcy in terms of the global economy, particularly on supply chain and trade, which have been affected. So as part of Brexit, there's been a lot of emphasis in the UK on a US-UK trade deal. Why is that the case? Why is that a particular point of interest?
Well, a good US-UK trade deal would mean the UK consumer accesses global prices because the US market's very competitive, which would be very good for the UK economy. And it would effectively offset many of the effects of not having an EU trade deal were that not to happen. And just one point on what I was just saying, the Eurozone risk is something currently mitigated by the UK, and the UK can do that after Brexit with a trade deal with the EU. If not, the US and UK will need to address Eurozone risk in as part of the new arrangement for the UK and US. But the US trade deal would benefit UK consumers and input prices for manufacturers here. It would potentially open up a massive, much larger global financial market. The US would get access through the UK to the rest of the world's financial markets in a way, because London is where global financial business outside the US is conducted. It's the other main global financial center. And that would be to the benefit of US consumers and businesses by enabling an easier and cheaper access to offerings, products, and capital from around the world for the US market. And also as part of that, there could be cheaper arrangements for US businesses seeking to do financial business in London.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but I think it's important that, we were talking about, the likelihood of the UK reaching a deal by the deadline with the EU. And now we're sort of talking about the significance and importance of the UK and United States reaching a trade deal for all of the reasons that you just articulated. But they're not really, those issues aren't really divorced from one another. Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, is come out and said that there's going to be no chance of the U.S. being able to reach a trade deal with the U.K. in the event that if in its view, the U.K.'s violated its international agreements. I think she just, came out and said that probably less than a week or so ago. So I'm interested in your thoughts there, because it seems as though the U.S. Congress may view one as being a necessary precedent for the other.
Well, on that, so that I think what you're talking about there is the fact that at the end of the year, the UK would need to override or basically tear up the withdrawal agreement of Northern Ireland Protocol and put in place some other arrangement for an invisible north-south border in Ireland, which it's committed to do already.
Yeah, that's really complicated, that deal, right, the Northern Ireland.
much less complicated than one might think. So it's possible, and obviously that needs to happen because of the Good Friday Agreement, the Belfast Agreement.
Right.
And I think that's what Nancy Pelosi is referring to. And the UK is committed to that invisible border. I don't think it would be in breach of international law at all for the UK to tear up the withdrawal agreement and Northern Ireland Protocol if it doesn't get the part of the bargain it got in that agreement, which is the future relationship under the political declaration, which, by the way, has in Article 4, the recognition of UK sovereignty and its internal market at year end. So if that's not forthcoming, that agreement effectively is void. But it does not mean that the UK is going to put up border posts on the island of Ireland or not honour the Good Friday Agreement. They're two very different things. So I don't see that as being a valid gating item for a relationship with the US. Now, whether the one with the US can be done before year end is obviously, that may be difficult.
There's a few things going on right now.
Right. Exactly, but I think so there is some connectivity with the US position, but I think the main point for the UK in the immediate term is progressing the US discussions, is the EU deal. The Eurozone point is at the root of the whole thing. It's technical, but it's exceedingly important because it explains why, in fact, the Northern Ireland Protocol can't be allowed to carry on, not least because the Eurozone is dumping underpriced products and goods on the UK and US markets, and engaged in unfair subsidisation, both in breach of WTO law. That affects the UK and US. The UK needs to be able to do something about that. The protocol prevents it. The commitment of the EU is at year-end to recognise UK sovereignty in the internal market, which means replacing that. So either it happens or it doesn't. If it doesn't, the UK needs to put in place different arrangements, alternative arrangements for that border. The other way of dealing with that border effectively is for the UK to write a guarantee. And I've been part of co-authoring a paper explaining all of this through an arrangement termed mutual enforcement, where the UK would guarantee effectively that EU, including Republic, customs and other standards were duties and legal standards were complied with for goods trucked across that border. And the EU would do the same in the other direction for the UK. And I don't think there's any valid reason for that not to be accepted. So I think it all can be threaded through, but the gating item in a way is the attitude of the EU as whether it's going to honor its commitments.
So there's a lot of focus on the Eurozone and the impact of Brexit, UK leaving on that, what that'll have on the global economy. But at the same time, the reality is we've got some macro level changes happening on the global geopolitics side. China is set to be the world's number one economy by the end of this decade. And so how does this sort of play to China's positioning now as sort of an economic powerhouse, given the sensitivities between UK, US and China right now, and how they'll also need stronger trade relationships?
Yeah, I mean, the default in trade with China, of course, like for anyone else, is WTO law, which is perfectly satisfactory, where there are remedies for dumping and subsidisation and so on. I mean, clearly the Chinese economy is growing. I see this, at root, I see an emerging difference, philosophical difference between what I think is a common law way of thinking, which is presumptively liberal, subject to restrictions and adjustments to make sure things are fair. President Trump refers to fair trade. Others in the US refer to fair trade. And a more civil law-based way of thinking, which is more controlling. And in particular, that has gone hand in hand. I don't know which is cause and the other is effect, but with a way that seeks to control the financial markets and economies. And in fact, that can be seen in the context of the Eurozone, which is, I do think, the fundamental to this whole thing, which is the EU has sought to control the market through the Eurozone. And yes, Brett, the currency works and is there, but we're talking about financial risk. So the question of financial or systemic risk is what happens if something goes wrong. And that's where everyone else ends up paying for it. So it does matter to everyone how this is handled, and it is the business of everyone to make sure it's mitigated. In terms of China, I see China on the trade side as wishing to go down the control route, and it has a legal system based on principally on the German codified method. And that, and the EU itself is going to face a choice as to whether to almost side with China on that sort of controlling mechanism, or to go more into an open free market world where it is able to transact with people willingly on WTO, you know, more on WTO and FTA, and ideally FTA models, which are more free trade based. I think the UK is clearly free trade. I actually think the US is free trade. I think the Commonwealth is free trade. All the Commonwealth countries, I think Japan is. So I think, you know, a large part of the world and the population, and in fact the largest growth part of the world in many ways, if you look at the Commonwealth countries, is free trade based on that philosophy. We'll just have to see how it shakes out. But I think, you know, China is at the moment pursuing a controlling civil law way of thinking.
Well, I think it's important just for listeners who aren't, you know, fully up to speed on the nuances between common and civil law, just really quick, main differences between the two systems. Common law countries such as the UK and the United States and 80 total common law countries throughout the world is that we take our case law is of paramount importance, as is the freedom of contract generally. We like parties to be able to freely negotiate with one another, and there are very few provisions that are sort of implied into contracts and the way businesses and individuals interact with one another, as opposed to the civil law, which is not case law driven. It's very much stat code driven, and freedom of contract is of less import in the sense that so much whether or not two parties, you know, agree to certain terms, so much is written and unofficially written and read into those contracts that really sort of take away some of the negotiating power between two, you know, in an arm's length transaction between two parties. So that's why everything that Barney just said is really important, because of that real philosophical difference. In my view, and I think it's of paramount importance in trade, financial services, what have you, that sort of that philosophical difference in the freedom of contract is really sort of what makes this incredibly tricky.
Yeah, well, you know, I think China's view of contracts generally in, you know, in the West, you can see that reflected. Having worked in China for many years, there's a lot of incompatibility when you get down to the actual contract level. What about some of the surrounding financial centers like Hong Kong and Singapore, Barney? Is there going to be some impact on their relationships with China and the broader globe?
Well, the relationships they have with China, in a way, will be pivotal is how events unfold. I mean, in principle, their markets built on the common law methodology, which Dara said is bottom up and case law driven and based on freedom of contract. So they're similar to the UK market and the New York market, the US market on that. A lot of that Asian business is done in London as well, which is why London alongside New York is equal top as a global financial center. So the question is how much is done regionally. I think that they are welcoming places for business with good support systems and regulatory infrastructure and good people. And I think they'll continue to be successful. But if China decided to try and divert business to Shanghai, I mean, it's in part doing that. But if it tried to do that more, I mean, I suppose it has the control over that. But civil law controlling ways of thinking, the capitalist ways of thinking, if you like, I think will be ultimately doomed in the financial market, because I think money goes where it's able to be best used and risk can be best allocated. So I don't think it's possible for a country the size of China to completely control the financial market. I think it will be a doomed thing.
I understand that, but China's form of colonialism is definitely more economic than British or US view of colonialism. And yeah, as part of that, they've invested not only, you know, they've about 60% of all investment in AI globally has been deployed in China the last decade. And more importantly, they've got this Belt and Road Initiative, which is designed to stimulate commerce cross-border and, you know, greater reach of the Chinese economy structurally. And so, you know, you do have that competing, you know, infrastructure play, which is pretty compelling, because if you look at the strength of the Euro economy, the US and UK economy, Japanese economy, very much built on, the 1960s, 1970s growth in, shipping capabilities and all of those things, the infrastructure required for trade, whereas China's making a 21st century play at that, right?
It is, and it's doing very well at the moment in pursuing that strategy, there's no doubt about it. But you asked whether it's going to squash Hong Kong or Singapore. I doubt it. I mean, obviously, it's not to say that it's impossible for it to do so if it wished to. It's doing an awful lot of what it's doing in the way that you say, through extending economic tentacles. So far, it hasn't sought to interfere with free markets in the free market world. And the free market world is vast if you look across the common law world and the embedded ways of thinking elsewhere. So I think the system is the free element, the common law way of thinking is capable of standing up for itself, withstanding that sort of tension. So I'm not dispirited on that front.
Yep. All right. Well, we're coming up on close of the session. Barney, just tell us a bit more about Shearman and Sterling and where you guys are based and where your activities are.
Well, we're a global law firm based, headquartered in New York and with offices in the main financial centers around the world. And we practice under, New York law, London, English law, and various other legal systems around the world. But we have offices, including having offices in China, Hong Kong, and Singapore, which you've mentioned. And we follow business flows and the needs of our clients. So both for transactions and for governance and advisory and regulatory help and litigation and disputes and all other forms of legal need.
Fantastic.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah, thank you so much, Barney, for joining us. I just had to quickly say that back in my former big law life, I had the pleasure of working with some of your colleagues in the New York office while I was still a big law lawyer and always enjoyed my interactions with them. But thank you so much for joining us. Anyone who hasn't should definitely check out some of Barney's writing and thoughts, particularly The Art of No Deal about Brexit. And it's been a pleasure.
And for me too. Thank you both very much.
Excellent. Well, let's go to break now. You're with Breaking Banks. We'll be back after the break with more great content.
Hey guys, it's Brett King from Breaking Banks here. Well, 2020 is the year that keeps on giving, a lot of uncertainty. How can businesses respond? Well, there's so much happening right now that finding the right people, the right talent is at least unconventional, if not time-consuming and frustrating. Recently, we had a couple of jobs that required support from external resources. One was the new logo design you see for Breaking Banks. I'm also doing the finishing touches on my new book, Techno-Socialism. I needed some research done on protests taking place around the world. And so I reached out to Fiverr. We're very grateful that Fiverr is a sponsor of Breaking Banks and Provoke Media. But whether you're launching your first business, scaling your current business, or in need of extra support, Fiverr's global network of on-demand freelance talent is available 24/7 to help. There's also 24/7 customer service. You can customize your search by service, deadline, price, seller reviews. You can negotiate with individual sellers as well. Freelancers have worked for some of the most influential brands in the world. So check out Fiverr.com and receive 10% off your first order by using our code BREAKING. Find all the digital services you need in one place at Fiverr.com. That's Fiverr.com, code BREAKING. Again, that's Fiverr.com, code BREAKING.
The pandemic may have warped all sense of time and reality, so here is a public service announcement. The holiday season is right around the corner, and this year, it's all going to be virtual. That means the holiday parties, the interactions with our key clients, and e-commerce already has exploded, and this year it is going to be more important than ever. So if you're an e-commerce seller or someone that asks to interact with your customers virtually through this season, now is the time to get ready with ShipStation. When you're selling online, getting a massive amount of orders out quickly can be tough. And if you're new to this pseudo e-commerce world, how do you keep track of who gets what? Which shipping carrier should you use? Are you getting the best rates? That's why we are using ShipStation.com. It is the fastest, easiest, and most affordable way to manage and ship your orders or gifts. In just a few clicks, you're managing things, printing out discounted shipping labels, and getting those packages out fast. The result? A happier holiday season for you and your staff that need to take care of this right away. ShipStation takes the hassle out of holiday shipping. ShipStation helps online sellers and shippers get orders out quickly, save money on shipping costs, and keep everyone happy. If you're an e-commerce player, no matter where you're selling, Amazon, Etsy, your own website, ShipStation brings all the orders into one simple interface, making them really easy to manage from any device, even your cell phone. ShipStation works with all the major carriers, the U.S. Postal Service, FedEx, UPS, even international. You can compare and choose the best shipping solution every single time. And right now, Breaking Banks FinTech listeners can get ShipStation free for 60 days when you use offer code FinTech. Make sure your business is ready to meet the demands of a massive online season. Get started at ShipStation.com today.
If you work for a bank or credit union, you already know that this budgeting and planning season is filled with more uncertainty and risk than ever before. And the answers you need aren't in your boardroom or in your spreadsheet models. The team at Alloy Labs has worked with some of the world's most innovative financial institutions, and now our Alloy Co-Labs can help you benefit from multiple perspectives as you learn hands-on how to apply industry-leading tools and frameworks to help you forge ideas into results quickly and cheaply. You can learn more at alloylabs.com/colabs, C-O-L-A-B-S. Our strategy collabs will help you prioritize what are always limited resources to defend and extend your core business while creating viable options for the future. And our customer discovery collabs will help you build a deeper understanding of your customers' changing needs. These are short, hands-on virtual sessions that'll help you get results fast. Space is extremely limited, so go to alloylabs.com/collabs to register now. Times of great change are also times of great opportunity, and the time to act is now. alloylabs.com/collabs.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
And now, here's more Breaking Banks.
Welcome to the extended mix of the Huawei Developer Conference, where we're having a podcast discussion today with a group of European payments experts, but we're definitely going to be talking about financial inclusion on a global basis, payments and how they're progressing on a global basis. We're going to talk about mobile versus traditional banking access, the role of identity, a bunch of stuff we're going to get into today. Our panelists or our speakers on our show today, we have Andreas Zimmer. He's the head of ecosystem and software strategy Europe for Huawei. His team is responsible for planning and leading the strategy for mobile ecosystems, mobile services, and consumer AI access across European markets. He joined Huawei in 2016 as a product manager for software and cloud services as part of the Consumer Business Product Center. Prior to that, he had various roles at Google and Universum, a consultancy from Sweden. Also joining us is Natalie Osterman. Is that correct, Natalie? How are you? Osterman. Okay. She's the Chief Operating Officer at Curve OS. Curve's a unique banking platform that connects multiple debit and credit cards into one smart card, all controlled with an easy-to-use app. And Curve believe the future isn't a better bank, but a better banking experience, enabling customers with a simple way to spend, send, see, and save their money. That's like a tongue twister at this time of the morning. She's a non-executive board member at Pay UK, so we'll be talking about payments and, you know, some of the sort of general issues around that. Prior to heading up the operations side at Curve. She worked as GM and head of Samsung Pay Europe at Samsung Electronics and is credited with building the organization and launching Samsung Pay across 6 European countries in 18 months. Also joining us is the head of mobile and digital banking of OP Financial Group, Krista Korelin. Is that right, Krista?
That's very good. Right. Thank you.
And Krista heads the digital and mobile banking business at OP Financial Group. It's the largest bank in Finland, steering the 130-year-old financial services co-op towards a data-driven, mobile-first world is her task or her job. So we've got a bunch of really good experts on payments and stuff like that. So let's get to it. You know, first of all, guys, you know, I know we're sitting in Europe and, you know, we're talking about sort of the European ecosystems and so forth. And, you know, I'll start off with an interesting story. You know, when we talk about the EMV standard, you know, for the chip card that, you know, we have obviously deployed most around the world. You guys are probably aware that the United States was the very last country to adopt the EMV standard. In fact, North Korea adopted the EMV standard before the United States did. And if you want to know why that is, I was at the Atlanta Fed at one point talking with the head of payments at Atlanta Fed about this and asked why the US hadn't yet adopted the chip card standard. This was prior to like 2016 or whatever when they rolled this out. And he said, well, what does EMV stand for? And I said, Europay, MasterCard, Visa Alliance, right? You know, like that. And he said, exactly, Euro. It's not a US-led strategy or initiative. You know, so we're going to find our own way, something better. So that didn't work, obviously, and we've come back to EMV. I trust my US listeners listening to this as well won't be offended by that. But so it's clear that when we're working in a sort of a global environment, particularly for payments, that standards are really important. And so, you know, obviously, chip and PIN or EMV, you know, that standard that's emerged has been pretty critical. But where do you guys see mobile payments fitting in, particularly in context of COVID? You know, do you think, generally speaking, that, you know, that we're moving away from, you know, like a single form factor for payments and we're moving more towards a world where, you know, the payments are sort of almost just built into experiences and frameworks around us. Maybe, Andreas, you know, where does the mobile fit in terms of the future of payments, where we're going to, from your perspective?
Yeah, so obviously, I mean, working at Huawei, I have my fair share of contact with mobile, right? What I find, I mean, mobile has become part of our lives, right? We have a smartphone penetration in Germany, at least I know of over 90%, right? That is quite ubiquitous, right? Maybe only bank accounts is something that more people have in terms of coverage, right? The other thing is when I did some research before the podcast here, is what I noticed is that on the other hand, things like online banking only have a penetration of around 61%. So, you know, I was wondering, you know, why is the smartphone penetration greater than the online banking penetration, given the fact, you know, you mentioned the current situation, given the fact that things like contactless payments now are becoming very, very much mainstream, right? Even in countries like Germany that have classically been maybe a little bit slower to adopt some technologies. So this is definitely one of the questions that I like to think about in my role, actually trying to kind of build that bridge between the two. I mean, what we're seeing is that people who maybe have never taken a contactless payment or mobile payment into consideration are actually starting to pick it up, right? Think about the proliferation of QR codes in daily life nowadays. Something that I think before March of this year was unthinkable in some places, that people would actually know how to use a QR code even, is also kind of, you know, it's getting mainstream. And, you know, Germany or Europe in general, I don't think it's not a mobile first society, right? But if you look abroad to say maybe China, those are countries that have sort of leapfrogged, right? So for them, you know, probably every three-year-old kid will know what a QR code can do, and every kid that is old enough to actually have some money from their parents will use a mobile phone to pay. So on the consumer side, I think it's quite interesting to see the kind of the great divide here.
Mm. Now, Krista, you know, you've already stated in your bio about your objectives for OP Group, you know, in terms of mobile first. But you know, I mean, Germany's a little bit of a different case from what we've seen. It appears, you know, but how do you go about increasing mobile adoption when it comes to payments and you know, banking in general?
That's a very good question. I think comparing to Germany, Finland has been very mobile first for a long time. We have a long tradition of building the vastest coverage of first 2G, then 3G, then 4G, and now 5G. And there has been a very strong political support for that also. We're a small country, and we have a lot of rural areas which are very scarcely populated. So we want the coverage to be for every single citizen, really. It's a question of accessibility. Our mobile banking usage is in a very high level already. We have a high smartphone penetration in the country, and about 50% of our entire customer base log into our mobile banking almost daily. So it's our active user base is phenomenal. And if we look at the sort of customer interactions that we have through our mobile banking, that's something that we're obviously working very hard on to make it as smooth as possible, so that people can enjoy that. When it comes to the corona crisis, that obviously increased, it decreased the number of cash transactions, but it also decreased the number of card transactions. We had a short lockdown, but it didn't really explain it all. What we did find is that because of online shopping and the different ways of payments online, that influenced also the card payments, not only the cash payments. So what we see is the increasing usage of mobile wallets, mobile payments, and mobile banking. So it's just a full range of mobile that is coming forward. Something that I also want to mention, we're testing several ways of identity when it comes to mobile. So we have been experimenting with biometric identification for a long time now. We have a fully functional face payment solution, for instance, which is open for all of our customers. So we are trying to, like you said, embed the experience so that it's not just the banking, it's also payments and identification in one. And that's something that we're working on and continue to work on.
That's very interesting. We got a lot to unpack with what you talked about there, particularly as we get into identity and facial recognition, which I would like to do in sort of the second half of the show as we talk a bit more about sort of global impact. But Natalie, when you talk about Curve, most people in the industry would probably classify you as sort of a card aggregator or something of that like. But really, you're talking about what happens from a payments experience perspective. And so, maybe talk about the evolution of where you think the payments experience will go, because you guys are more about data, you know, what happens
Brett,
before
you read my mind. After, that was exactly where I wanted to go. You know,
after the transaction rather than the modality of the transaction itself. So you know, talk to me contextually about how payments are changing as a result of technology like mobile and, you know, data aggregation, AI and so forth.
Yeah, fabulous question. Because I, as I was listening to everybody, I thought I would explain a little bit of what I've seen, because I've been in the mobile world in a very serious way since 2015. And I think I've seen a lot of changes. And you know, this includes global changes in terms of how people are using their mobile devices in the payment context. So, you know, if you look, I'm based here in London and in the UK, and in 2015, contactless was just coming around. People were just starting to tap with their phones. In fact, Transport for London is the one that is credited with contactless taking off. And that was really important at the time when I was in my job at Samsung Pay, because we were struggling with how do you introduce this new form factor. It came at the same time as well, Apple was coming out with their mobile offering for payments. And we actually had to think about how we were going to train cashiers that this is an acceptable form of payment, tapping with your phone or even tapping with your card. I mean, so there were some basic instructions we needed to leave at the cashier or the till before you paid, which is incredible to think now, because now we pretty much do it without thinking. But a mere 5 years ago, that was not normal. And it was really Transport for London, at least within London, that really pushed that forward, because people started to get used to tapping their card to get through the turnstiles. And that's how it took off. Of course, then all the terminals changed as well. And if you fast forward to today and I think about the different form factors, that was your intro, Brett. You said, you know, there's different ways of paying around the world and there's different ways that this can be done. And as we all know, in Asia, it's QR codes. In Africa, it's slightly different. It's actually via sometimes text. It's moving forward a little bit more. But I was just in Africa actually last year, last summer, and it's still, you know, M-Pesa and texts, especially in rural Africa. But so you think about the QR codes, not at all prevalent here in Europe, right? Not something you see very, it's not usual for Europeans to use it. It is commonplace for a Chinese person visiting at their favorite shops like Louis Vuitton in France to have that QR code, because of course WeChat and Alipay are accepted. But the funny thing is COVID has helped with QR codes, because we're no longer touching menus. And I credit this time the pubs and restaurants with this being an acceptable method now in Europe. We're all now used to scanning if we go out for the menu to be accepted. And I think that's a very important change that will start to result in it all the form factors coming together. People are now used to tapping. People are now used to scanning for a QR code. So I think it's really becoming ripe for all types of payment methods to be acceptable. And just to put a little bit on the platform, how you started the question, in the intro about Curve, we don't care who you bank with, we just want to give you a better banking experience. It's because we know that it's all very different experiences as you go across your different payment products or payment needs. And we're trying to create one unified experience so you can see spend, send, and save.
There's the tagline.
Yeah. There you go. Know,
my tagline was, you know, for Moovin was spend, save, and live smarter. So it sounds similar, you know, but in fact, I don't know, some trivia for you guys, but we launched the very first contactless form factor in 2012 in the US for the first mobile challenger bank in the world, obviously Moovin. And it was an RFID/NFC sticker you put on the back of your phone. This was prior to even Google Wallet deploying in the US market, of course. So I appreciate what you're saying, Natalie. The education piece of that was you know, a lot of users wanted it, but they'd walk into shops and and the merchants were like, what are you doing? Why are you putting your phone on the
In 2015, I had a lot of people chasing me out of the store saying, yeah, wait a minute, I think, did you pay?
Did that pay? Yeah, did you actually, did that happen? So, yeah, I'm Yeah, it's really interesting when we talk about China as a QR code ecosystem, because actually 60% of the payments made in the retail stores last year weren't done by QR code, but facial recognition. And so, you know, China has solved one of the biggest problems with a PAN, you know, or the 16-digit number of a card, even when it's tokenized, which is linking identity accurately to a payment artifact, so you can't have identity theft, as an example, right? And so, you know, they've sort of leapfrogged, you know, the West in respect to solving the identity problem there. Of course, there's a lot of debate around facial recognition. But Krista, you talked about the fact you guys are using facial recognition. Tell me about how customers are accepting of this in terms of this technology specifically.
That's a good question, because every time I mention face payments or I, you know, present it to someone, the first question is always security, you know, identity theft. How do you prevent this from being misused? So basically, just to give you a brief background, this is something that we started testing about 2 years ago. And I don't know if you're familiar with the startup conference Lush, which takes place in Helsinki. And
yeah, I've spoken at it a couple of times.
Yes.
Yeah.
At a very slushy November, usually.
Yeah.
So we launched it there last year, and we've had it since live in 5 different locations in Finland. So it's not, you know, rolled out widely across the 3.6 million customers or to the entire population. It is in certain points of sale. And we're testing it out, and we want the experiences, and we want the customer feedback. So we're very much in a phase where we see, you know, how does it work? What's the experience like? What do customers think about it? How much security is an issue? How much the identity, you know, is how much do customers feel that there are issues still? And the feedback that we get from the users is brilliant. They love it because, you know, it's so clear and simple. You have an application that you download, and after the first time usage, after the first sort of strong identification that you give that, it's just literally, it's like 4 seconds on a cashier and you're gone. And it's really easy. It's really smooth. And what we have in the POS, the point of sale, we have a terminal which, you know, speaks to me. So if I go and pay, they say, "Hey, Krista, how are you? Here's your payment. Is this the amount that you want to pay? Please, you know, identify yourself with your face." And then, and after that, I get a notification on my phone saying, yes, the transaction was accepted. So from a customer experience point of view, I think once you try something like that, it feels impossible to go back. It feels impossible to go back to getting your phone out, getting your wallet out, you know, whatever it is that you're paying with. So
it's much more sci-fi.
So the user feedback has been really, really positive. Now, obviously, then what happens is that once we talk with partners, you know, cafes or retailers who could apply that, then obviously we do come to into this question, like, do people feel safe? So far, it has been so that As the number of euros is not, you know, you're not paying a car with it. You're paying, you know, something smaller. It feels like, yes, it's secure. Another very strong asset that we have is our brand in Finland. We're an old operator in a financial industry. You know, we have a very trustworthy brand, and, you know, we do our best to keep it
that way. So people trust you guys
will
handle that technology appropriately.
Yes. Yeah. So that really helps us, and that's why you know, we're probably seen as reliable as the Finnish state. You know,
fantastic. Maybe Andreas, let me pass the baton to you at this point. In Germany, you know, there's obviously going to be some challenges for something like biometrics-based payments or capturing your face and using that. So, you know, how do you see the challenges in respect to the market, specifically in Germany, how these types of technologies we're seeing that are successful in China, for example, you know, could they be introduced in Germany, or are the hurdles too great?
Or in Finland, mind you. I mean, I mean, I found the example from Krista extremely exciting. Actually, I love to see these kind of this kind of innovation come out of Europe as well, right? But I think it's fair to say that the country or the population needs to be ready for this, right? And as I said initially, right, in the meantime, we've managed to get like a high smartphone penetration in Germany, but still only maybe, 60% even have their bank app installed on their phone. You know, why is this? I think the jury is out. I don't know exactly why, but I would say that probably privacy and security considerations are part of this. I mean, certainly when it comes to things like face recognition, this is technology that's really new, right? Because in order to do face recognition, which is it's a part of artificial intelligence, you actually have to have computing power that supports this kind of operation, right? And you have to have trained a model with enough data to be able to do this, to deliver this service reliably. And we've only been able to sort of do this for the past few years. You have this law where over time the computing capacity increases and the cost per byte sort of decreases. And now we're at the point where these kind of things are actually, they make sense economically as well. From our perspective, some of the topics that Huawei has been really, really invested in is the whole topic of on-device AI. And the reason why on-device AI is such an exciting topic is because it takes this whole privacy and security topic at its very core, right? Because if you don't share your face to be kind of analyzed in a cloud, then the possibility for identity theft or whatever you might be scared of in this context is minimized. So, in the meantime, a lot of companies, including Huawei, have launched phones that have very sophisticated biometric identification in there. And I think this will make a lot of this kind of technology possible in the future and even get sort of countries on board where privacy and security is a major consideration in whether or not to adopt it. So this is something that we at Huawei are very, very focused on to be sure to deliver kind of this secure and private solution that works on device. And we're doing our part to try to educate our users to make sure that that they know that this feature exists. And I mean, we know that our users trust us. So we are using that also to kind of further the technology and also awareness for this kind of technology.
So Natalie, I know you've been involved a lot in identity infrastructure and thinking about this. One of the things we're realizing, particularly in the midst of COVID, is that the old identity methods we use, a driver's license or a passport, those physical identity documents, and those old data points we use, like your mother's maiden name, your date of birth, your best friend's cat's dog's name or something, those things that we've traditionally used to try and migrate the physical identity to the digital world are just not really working in sort of digital frameworks. So in the past, the way we've tackled payments is we've said, we'll authenticate you at the start. When you open a bank account, we'll identify you. And from that point forward, we'll assume that you are the owner of that bank account whenever you transact. And we can authorize that with a signature, or a PIN number, for example. Whereas, China with the facial recognition scheme have really tied identity into every transaction and sort of a much stronger identity basis than, a signature, which, is pretty fragile from a security perspective today. So in terms of identity infrastructure, how do we solve this? How do we get people to understand that in the digital world, we need a much more robust way of thinking about identity that the old system and sort of trying to retrofit that onto online is not really working?
Sure. And I can use my past experience at Idemia, where we were really focused on digital identity. And I absolutely, Andreas, want to unpick a little some of the things that you said at Huawei, because there are some challenges that we have to face, no matter who it is, in terms of digital identity. So, because we were talking about developed versus developing countries, one of the things with digital identity is that we saw two kinds of models emerging in the world. A centralized database with identities like Aadhaar in India. I would argue that in China as well, through WeChat, there's a centralized identity. And then you have a more decentralized model in more developed countries, Europe being particularly strong because of privacy concerns from lots of different countries where people are very unwilling to share their identity beyond the government. And so you have these two models, both, I would say, with their flaws, and they need to be overcome. So the number one question, if you're going to talk about payments and digital identity, and you know, I think about this as I'm a platform trying to bring together lots of different payments, is how do you port your identity? How do you make sure, like, open banking is the big thing we talk about, but if you're going to talk about open banking, you need to talk about digital identity. Because otherwise you have to sign up for account after account after account. And that's very painful. But I understand why you have to do that. You have to do that because the bank needs to know their customer. It's a regulation. They need to know that. And they need to do that kind of work. Once that's been done, are they, and this is Andreas where I'm going to kind of unpick, and this is something that Huawei will have to think about, is the bank willing to accept the device as an acceptable payment method over and above, let's say, the pins and things like that that they have put into place or the technology that they have put into place and controlled. I'm sure Krista will tell me she wants to control and make sure she is not being fraudulent, you know, there's not a fraudulent user and everything like that. She wants to make sure that that's happening. And so this digital identity question, which I thought was so clear to be cracked, is actually really, really hard because you need to get back to a source of truth, and that is governments. It's your birth certificate, which turns into your passport, which turns into a license, which turns into a digital identity. And those sources of truth go back to each and every government, and different governments are doing this in different ways. And, you know, I would say a lot of the developing countries are doing that much more quickly because of financial inclusion and needing to get people access to money. And that's great. And it's a very weird thing. So they're going to be leapfrogging in terms of digital identity and being more comfortable, whereas us here in Europe are still struggling and everybody wants to own the digital ID. And as a consumer, it's not a great experience. I need to prove who I am over and over again with my passport.
Yeah, which is, I mean, obviously, every time you go to a new bank, if you change countries, you know, you suddenly, you know, no one knows who you are anymore, you know? No one knows your credit record, no one knows, and every bank you go to, it's, you know, producing 17 pages of identity information to prove who you are again. When, from a consumer perspective, it seems fairly simple. It's like, well, this other bank knows who I am. Why can't you check with them? Or why can't you check with the government? You know, I've got a driver's license. They know who I am, you know? And so, yeah, clearly. So that's very interesting because, you know, my conclusion is something similar, Natalie, is that if you look at financial inclusion, the greatest improvements we've had in financial inclusion have happened in the last, you know, 10 or 15 years as a result of two major changes. One is introduction of mobile wallets, and the second is introduction of centralized ID systems. So if you look at India, for example, almost 1 billion people have come into the financial services sector for the first time, and they tried with bank branches. They tried it for many years, insisting that 25% of the bank branches opened in the country must be opened in rural centres where financial inclusion was an issue. And the thing that became very clear was even if they opened branches in those rural locations, people didn't qualify for a bank account because they didn't meet the identity requirements.
Well, so, and they also didn't always have a signature, couldn't read as well.
Exactly, yeah. And so that's where the Aadhaar card, as you mentioned, has been phenomenally successful. And when you look at China,
it also reduced a lot of fraud.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Now, of course, the nature of a centralized database means it could be hacked theoretically. You know, there has been some potential issues with that in India, although small comparatively. But you know, we can then get into DLT and decentralized identity as an argument, but that's off the track. I will say that you know, given this. At this juncture where we're talking about the fact that these greenfield solutions, centralized identity based on biometrics, a dark card with a fingerprint, China with facial recognition, this is showing clear benefits in terms of reduction in identity theft and fraud. And so, you know, when we see greenfield, you know, all these new mobile wallets entering the African market, and obviously, Ant Group and others are investing in payments throughout Asia. So we can imagine a world in, you know, 5 to 10 years' time when everyone in Asia is using their face to pay for stuff. And in Africa, you know, maybe something similar. Certainly the mobile phone is going to be a part of that. But, you know, you're talking about fairly robust digital infrastructure based on biometrics, digital identity infrastructure. And yet, when we look at the West, we're still going to have that issue. But more importantly, I'm really interested in, you know, what is the bank account going to be like globally? Because in China and in Africa, it's almost appears as if the dominant day-to-day spending account, let's call it your discretionary spending account, is a mobile wallet, right? So something embedded in your mobile. That's your primary day-to-day bank account. Now, of course, you might have savings and investments and a mortgage with a traditional FI, but your day-to-day stuff is sort of channeled through that mobile wallet. Whereas in the West, we've gone with this card model over the last 50 years, since the 1970s. So where do these two worlds collide? Maybe, Andreas, you know, from Huawei's perspective, being born of China in that ecosystem, you know, do you guys think that the mobile wallet embedded in the operating system is where it's going to happen in the future? You know, sort of like you know, Google, Samsung, Apple, you know, all sort of trying to do something along those lines? Or is it just more shoving a plastic card inside the phone analog that we've seen?
Shoving a plastic card inside the phone. If you have a dongle for that, then that is possible. But I mean,
West, you know, we've got a representation of a plastic card inside the phone, which it's right. Not really necessary, but it's the way we've done it as an analog, right?
Right. Exactly. No, but what I want to see is I want a phone, or I want connected devices that are dongle-less, right? I want devices that can work in and by themselves. You know, to answer your question, I mean, I think most importantly, I think that payments will go beyond the phone, right? Payments will go to other touch points as well. I very strongly believe that we're seeing that payments are already available on watches now, right? And I think that the whole payment process will be more seamless across other devices in the future. Now, how this payment is kind of facilitated through the phone is a very, very interesting question. I think it is our responsibility to kind of make sure that every user has access to a form of payment on the device, right? I mean, the user will still be able to decide essentially, you know, what kind of system they want to use, right? If they want to use a card-based kind of wallet, okay. If they want to use a QR code-based sort of solution, that is also fine. From our perspective, what we are trying to do is trying to enable a multi-touch point secure solution platform, if you will, that then companies can sort of build on, so and use to distribute their solution to the end user, and the end user will decide. Now, obviously, this will also be driven ultimately by acceptance, right? And I think that's the there's two parts of financial inclusion in my point of view. One is to include as many users, end users, consumers, to be able to make payments. The other one is to also enable businesses, more merchants, to actually also take payments, because that is also for a small business, for a mom and pop shop, right? No matter where, cash was king, right? Now people are coming with their phones and, you know, putting the phone, can you take my payment there? I still find it very fascinating, this image that I have burned in my mind from China, where you go on any market in even rural China and you'll have the sellers in the market, you'll be able to pay them with a QR code. That is true.
And all they need, right, is like a photocopy of a QR code. They don't even need their own phone, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And for me, that is where we should be. Every merchant and every user should ultimately be able to be connected digitally through devices. You know, for us, I don't think we have a strong opinion whether or not it has to be a card or a QR code or open banking as like a direct bank account connection. I think the user will decide.
Yeah, very interesting. Natalie, you know, looking at a few years, let's say, you know, 3 to 5 years, based on what we've seen during COVID, how would you imagine the payments experience would evolve? You talk about smarter banking experience. So what is the intelligence that is coming into the experiences that's different from just, yeah, this is the merchant and this is how much you spent? You know, what other intelligence do we need to bring into those daily payments experiences?
Yeah, so I'm going to bring around a lot of the discussions we've just had here. So I do think it will all be on the mobile, on your phone. I already only carry my phone and no longer carry my wallet. I think that your identity will be on your phone. I think in 5 years' time, we will have cracked that. The main OEMs will start to do it and it will become an acceptable form of payment like a PIN code is, or governments will step up and start to do that. But I also think that we will have a choice of form factors. So you will be able to pay at a terminal, pay with a QR code, or pay in different ways. And really, I mean, for me, nirvana, you know, the ultimate would be when the customer gets to decide. It's not the company giving the services that decides for the customer. The customer gets to choose how they want to have their own personalized experience. Some people don't feel comfortable with their face. That's fine. Use a PIN. If you feel comfortable with your face, that's fine. Use your face. You know, I think those will be very acceptable. But for me, it's about, I have multiple banking relationships around the world, by the way, right? An American, a French American based in London with accounts in Europe as well. I want to be able to see everything across all of my accounts. I want to be able to seamlessly go across my accounts in a manner that is supposed to be the open banking dream. And I do think that will happen in 5 years. And so that for me is what would be ideal. I do want to put my money in different places and in different countries. It just suits me. But I want to be able to deal with that in one place. And then I want to be able to do a lot of different things with that money all in one place.
Good. Well, we've only got a couple of minutes left. Just Krista, very quickly, how has COVID has COVID changed customers' expectations? But can you keep it brief?
I think the COVID has brought customers back to basics in many ways. I think our customer satisfaction was pretty much all-time high during the COVID, mainly because we were really active in mortgage payment postponements agreements and supporting the SMEs in their loans, so that we put out about 700 million euros back to the society as liquid funds just by postponing some of the payments. So I think COVID has increased the digital penetration, but it also has brought people back to, you know, what really counts. And banks have a societal role, and banks have a responsibility, a very strong social responsibility, which also needs to be taken into account. So I think that's something that happened, at least in Finland.
Okay, guys, just to wrap up, if people want to continue this conversation with you guys online, in the digital sphere, this is something you always do at the end of a session like this. How do we get in contact with you? What's the best way? Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook? Andreas, you start.
So Twitter is fine. It's @AndreasZimmer. Very straightforward. Great. And LinkedIn, also happy to connect. So that's in/azimmer.
Great. Natalie?
LinkedIn is great. I'm a great LinkedIn user. So Natalie Usman on LinkedIn.
And what's Curve's Twitter ID?
Curve.
Just Curve, at Curve. Great. And Krista?
LinkedIn works fine. I'm easy to find there. If you want to find me on Twitter, I'm Krista Nadia. So that would be a bit of a different handle there. But at least LinkedIn is easy.
Great. Well, thanks for joining us today, guys. Great discussion on financial inclusion and how mobile is going to change the payments landscape and inclusion landscape. It's been a great time, and thank you again.
That's it for this week. If you like the show, make sure to give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform, or share it with a friend, or share it on social media.
You can listen to all of our more than 300 episodes, plus all of the other shows from Provoke.fm Media, and learn more about being a guest, a partner, or a sponsor, all at Provoke.fm.
We'll see you again next week with more Breaking Banks.